my pleasant efforts, although somewhat more speculative. The idea is to talk about very, very weak introductions, and inevitably we'll run into the problems that we're missing 23% of the matter in the universe. Very broadly, what we're interested in particle physics is not necessarily to enumerate all the different resonances and particles we have, it's not chemistry, but rather to really develop a new understanding of the principles that shape this universe, the symmetries that tell us how things interact. And the kind of questions we ask is, for example, what is the origin of the Lechowick scale? That's one of the forces in nature, and we still don't quite know why it has the scale it does. Another question that we would love to have a positive answer for, are there any other forces in nature, aside from those four that we already know? And the reason why this connects to new principles, new symmetries, is because most of the forces we know of are described by gauge symmetries. What we would love to discover in that is if, for example, it's maybe a new space-time symmetry, aside from Lorentzian inverse, maybe supersymmetry. One of the big questions we clearly have a problem in is, what is matter made of? Okay, the description we have right now is missing a large portion of the universe. So these are the type of questions that particle physicists like to ask themselves, and ultimately this is an empirical science, so they would like to make searches, experimental searches for those sort of ideas. And before we delve into the different searches we have, I'd like to divide for us the type of searches one can do. The first type of search I'll discuss is what I'll call principle-based searches. Those are experimental efforts which are motivated by some very deep theoretical principles that we all believe is either important or already well established. So the very first example is top discovery. We knew that the top has to be there because of an Lechowick gauge invariance, and so people knew that it's out there. We knew what its quantum numbers are. We almost understood everything about that system. The only thing we didn't know is what is its mass scale, and ultimately we discovered it to be pretty heavy. But the entire effort was really motivated by this deep principle. Unitarization of W boson scattering. The main reason why we build LHC is because we would like to understand what happens when you scatter W boson hard enough, and that boils down to issues of unitarity, which is a sacred principle. Higgs boson has to do with renormalizability, and ultimately, of course, supersymmetry will be wonderful to find very deep principles there, and if nothing else, will solve for us the hierarchy problem. So those are just a few of many, many examples of searches which are motivated by some deep principle that every theorist at least loves in some level, or at least aspire to imitate. But there are other type of searches, and those are the type of searches I'll discuss today. And those are what I call phenomenological searches. They're not based on any deep principle, but rather they're based on anomalies, observations, things we see that don't quite fit the current paradigm or the current picture we have, and examples abound. Quantum mechanics was discovered as a phenomenological search. None of our theorists expected quantum mechanics, and yet it's there. We first saw its effects in black body and ultimately everywhere. Another example that will play a role a little later again is neutrinos. We did not expect neutrinos, and yet they are there, and now we even know something about their properties. Again, there is no deep principles that force them to be there, but they are there. And the discovery of the Tao, rather the entire third generation, is another such example. There is no deep principle that tells us that we must have three generations. The kind of searches I'll discuss today is maybe one of the biggest problems we have currently in the star model, is that the fact that there is dark matter out there that we don't account for. And this is just an empirical fact, like it or not. Okay? So those are the type of searches that I'll discuss today. And what do theorists do faced with this sort of searches? What can a theorist help with? So one thing you can do is, of course, construct new models. That is somewhat difficult if you want to construct a beautiful model, because there are no real principles that that help you to come up with that. Of course, it's easy to come up with crazy ideas, but real beautiful ones are far and few in between. Propose new searches. If you actually have a model in mind, The next thing you want to do is to think, are there any particular signatures? After all, we want to test those ideas as much as we can. Anomalies abound, as we'll see. You want to try to propose new alternative explanations for them. One thing that is a must, if you want to take it seriously, is you better know all the available data out there and try to critically examine it and see what it tells you about the models you have to make sure that you're not just chasing something that is already excluded. And finally, in your free time or deep at night or sometimes, you should actually calculate something that can be observed. Okay, so those are the type of things that theorists think about, theorists who care about from logical searches. And you'll see examples of that throughout the talk. So, but let's start by giving you a very strong motivation that such searches can be very fruitful and discover new physics. Neutrinos are an example. Neutrinos were first noticed as missing energy momentum in beta decay. It took Pauli to suggest a new particle and 23 more years to actually discover it. And 50 more years to realize that they have non-trivial properties, namely their masses and mixing. And the kind of experiment you had to build to really get them to show their faces are huge water tanks or other kind of liquids that neutrinos can interact with. Because they are so weakly interacting, you really need a lot of matter to see it. And that is actually a recurring theme that is now becoming more and more important in the search for new physics. So what about dark matter? There is a very strong analogy with dark matter. It was also realized as a missing something, namely mass, by Zwicky almost more than 70 years ago. And over the past 70 years, we really accumulated many other evidences for its existence on many different length scales. But the big difference between neutrinos and dark matter is that neutrinos, we knew from day one how they interacted. And that sort of completely motivated all the ways we are searching for them, and that made life easy. For dark matter, we have no such guarantee. We really have no idea how it interacts aside from its gravitational effects. So those here, I'm showing you the two of the... This is an actual current experiment that is running. This is a big proposal for its continuation. And those two experiments will definitely play a big role in shaping our understanding of dark matter in the next decade. Okay, so the content of this talk, I'll tell you about weakly interacting matter, and that will sort of exemplify for us what I'll call the exposure frontier. Then I'll tell you about very weak interactions, and that will exemplify the precision frontier. And if we have time, I'll show you that those things can even be probed in the energy frontier, namely the LHC. And there are very interesting new objects that arise when you start considering that type of interaction. So, without further ado, let's go and see what the exposure frontier can tell us about very weakly interacting matter. So, as I mentioned already, dark matter was discovered more than 70 years ago by looking at rotation curves of clusters of galaxies. It was then realized that galaxies themselves have those sort of rotation curves which are anomalous. They don't really account for all the matter that is seen. Later on, we all start seeing it in lensing effects, and now there is a whole booming field of microlensing in astrophysics. The Bullet cluster is maybe the most pronounced evidence for dark matter. Those are two galaxies that are swimming through each other, and you can really map out the total matter distribution as compared to the luminous part, which sort of gets attenuated in the middle. And our most precise knowledge of dark matter comes from WMAP. It informs us how much is out there globally in the universe, very, very precisely, with three significant digits or so. But of course, all of those evidences, as astonishing as they are not telling us anything about how we interact aside from gravitation. And so what we'd really like to do is to start producing dark matter if possible, and that's where the LHC could come into the game. And this is very analogous to neutrino reactors, right? One of the best way we know about neutrinos is because we can actually produce them in reactors. Another big effort over the past several years that produced many interesting results, big anomalies, is indirect detection. The idea is that dark matter may annihilate somewhere in the galaxy, and you can observe those effects. But the type of efforts I'll discuss today are actually more to do with direct detection efforts. And that is the idea of making direct contact with dark matter itself. So what is direct detection? It is important to realize that this effort really has no guarantee coming from this side, because this is not telling us about the gravitational attraction. So you should have in your mind a very strong divide between this part, which is telling us everything else but its gravitational attraction, and the other side, which is more definite. So the speculative is let's push along and see how far we can go with it. So how would you really know that there is matter out there that is unambiguous? You get pushed by it. And what do you mean by how do you get pushed by something? You stand in front of it, right? And this is these efforts. If dark matter is out there in the halo, the Earth is moving through the halo, and this gas of particles, if it is, every once in a while will collide with your target. So you place some sort of target in your detector, and you just wait. And you wait for dark matter to come in and make contact with one of your nucleus and recoil against it. So the actual dark matter you'll not see again, it leaves, you won't leave any more trace, but what you hope to record is a nuclear recoil event. Okay. So all those experiments produce a certain canonical plot, which is more or less the only thing you can observe. What's plotted here is the energy that is deposited in the event versus some sort of discrimination variable that I'll tell you about in a moment more. But you can already see why it's important to have this discrimination, because all the events you see here is not dark matter collision, or at least not obviously so. This is most likely just background. It's electronic background. And those experiments realize they have this background, so they have a rejection against that this band is not where you want to look. You really want to look in this band here. And this is, of course, the famous two events from CDMS over the last summer, or two summers ago. And there are good reasons to believe they're not real events. But so for the sake of the argument, let's just say they're not real events, and if you want to argue with me about it, I can throw close at you. But really, let's for a moment imagine that those were not there. What do you do given the fact that you have not observed anything interacting? Well, you know how long you sat there, you know how much target you have, and so if you assume a cross-section, you know how many events you would expect. So therefore, if you have not seen anything, you can bound the cross-section of dark matter against the nucleus. And this is what all those different experiments eventually produce. It's a plot of the dark matter mass, you understand in a moment why it's important, against the cross-section. Okay, since I've not seen anything, I know that the cross-section for a given mass has to be lower than any one of those curves. Okay, the reason why the mass is important is because we know how much mass density is during the halo, so the larger the dark matter mass is, the lower the number density, and so ultimately if it's heavy enough, you just want to interact with it. There's not enough of them around. And if you go to lower masses, you won't see anything because you cannot stop a Mach truck with a ping pong ball. If your dark matter is much, much lighter than your nucleus, it just won't recoil against it, right? Won't leave any energy. So that's why those experiments are ultimately stop it around a GeV, a mass of a GeV. Okay, but this is the canonical plot in all those different experiments. And what I want to devote a moment for is this axis here, the discrimination, because all those different experiments are really different in that respect. And this plane here sort of detonates the different detection schemes. So how can you detect energy? Because that's a general question. Well, energy can be scintillation, basically photons. Energy can be ions, right? Basically electrons that drift for your detector. And energy can also be heat, phonons. When dark matter hits your target, if it does so, it can deposit all three types of energy, right? Scintillation, ionization, and heat. And the different experiments utilize different techniques. For example, one of the oldest experiments in the field, CDMS, use both ionization and heat to detect dark matter. And discrimination is you take a ratio between how much heat was deposited and how many ions you saw. And the idea is that the electrons will create many more ions than a Wimp recoil. Okay.
Why do you assume it's an elastic collision?
That's an excellent question. So I should have said that, and I won't assume that in a moment. This transition from this plot to this plot is model dependent. It assumes elastic scattering, and so it's important to keep in mind exactly this point, that while this is model independent, it's just data, this plot here, you should always keep in mind there is model assumption behind it, and we'll get to this point in a moment. Xenon, which is one of the biggest hopes for the next decade, use ionization and scintillation. And interestingly enough, the one experiment that actually has positive claims doesn't use two methods, it only uses scintillation. So already you should be a little bit nervous about such efforts. And again, another experiment that has some sort of claims, semi-claims, is cogent. There are orders three times more experiments available on the market than I'm showing here. And this field is really booming because those are very cheap experiments relatively speaking. And there are many different techniques that are being used and different targets. Okay, so just to illustrate those points a little more, let's go to and see one of the anomalies out there, the only positive claim for detection, and I want to take it seriously for a moment.
Can I just, ask a question? But you're not going to talk about LHC producing that method.
No.
To what extent does that wipe out the necessity for all of these experiments?
Not really, because for one thing, it can always be, you know, dark matter can also always be a 10 TeV, in which case you will never produce the LHC. So even that, just that is
but in general,
there is some sensitivity, certainly, there is an interesting interplay between those different fronts. In the next decade, we'll definitely need both. So what is this Dama Libra experiment? It's an experiment located deep underground in Gran Sasso, Italy, and they use sodium alloy crystals. You have those crystals, they sit deep in the mountain, and you just, as I said, you just sit there and wait, and you want to see nuclear recoils. Now, it's important to realize that as the sun moves through the halo, right, this is this gas of dark matter particles that you're moving through, there is some sort of effective wind that you're encountering. But at the same time, we know already from many centuries ago that our Earth is moving around the Sun, and so as the seasons change, your relative velocity, our Earth has a relative velocity that changes with respect to this wind. So what you expect is to see some sort of seasonal modulations of the event rate if there are any recoils that has to do with dark matter. The amazing thing is that since the late 90s, we have seen, or this experiment is claiming such oscillations. This is this plot. What's called here is time. Those are days, so you see here many, they already have like around 8-9 years of data, plotted against the residual in the rate. So basically you take the average and you subtract from the average. Okay, so you see those modulations precisely. So that is really a remarkable result, especially since both the frequency and the phase agree with what you expect from annular seasonal modulations. So why is there no big uproar we discover dark matter? It's because this experiment has been tested with other experiments like CDMS, Xenon 10, CREST, Xenon 100, and none of them see any events that would indicate a discovery. And so when they make a transition from this data to the plot, here it is, this canonical plot that I already mentioned. You have a mass of the dark matter here versus this cross-section. You see, this is where Dama's favorite region is. If you believe the oscillations are real, that's the kind of dark matter properties you'll need. You'll need a dark matter of roughly 100 GeV and a cross-section of 10 to the minus 40. But that is very, very strongly ruled out by those other experiments, by several orders of magnitude. Let's not get into this region. If you're interested, I can tell you it doesn't quite work, so no point in talking about it too much. But it's very strongly excluded by other experiments, but as was pointed out here, this is a model-dependent statement. Okay, so are there any kind of other interactions which are not too crazy that dark matter can have that actually are compatible, could explain why certain experiments see those and other experiments don't? Okay. So I wanted to structure in the next few slides exactly one such possibility. That goes under the name of magnetic inelastic dark matter. So several years back, Neil Weiner and David Tucker Smith realized that the fact that iodine is so heavy is actually important. And the other things we realized just recently is once you plot those elements with their natural properties, so what I'm plotting here right now is not dark matter, but rather the actual elements used in those direct detection experiments, this is where the data starts to matter. So what do they use? For example, some experiments use xenon, okay? That's why it's called xenon, right? Dama uses sodium iodide. Another experiment uses argon. Another experiment uses tungsten. All the different experiments, that's what makes them so interesting, use different targets. And what I'm plotting here is the atomic mass of those different elements versus the magnetic dipole of the nucleus. Okay? And you see the Dama, which is a sodium iodide, occupies a very interesting place in this plot. It is both either very heavy and very large dipole, or very light and very large dipole. So those affect the kind of interactions you have and the kind of kinematics you see and motivate a certain very simple model, which, if you think about the hydrogen hyperfine transition, will come.
Did you just weight the other elements with the corresponding set of isotopic natural values?
Right. So that's a good point. I sort of skipped this point, but not all the isotopes of xenon have a magnetic dipole. So just one or two of them actually have it. And what I'm calling here is the average of that, but that's what matters for the actual detection. Okay, so what comes to mind is maybe a magnetic dipole interaction.
How
do
you average?
I'm multiplying by the natural abundance.
No, but you have to add them. Squares.
Oh, that's what you meant, yeah. No, it's no funny tricks with a minus sign there. There is no constellation, there is a So what kind of transition is it? It's a magnetic dipole interaction. If you think about the hyperfine transition in hydrogen, it's exactly that. It's not too strange. And the kind of matrix element associated with it is dark matter, real photons, and excited state of dark matter. If you really dislike it, think about hydrogen ground state, hydrogen hyperfine state, and light, right? That's the kind of interaction you have here. Only the dipole size is much, much smaller, okay? It's the dipole size you will see you need is roughly 100 times smaller than the dipole of the proton. I have one model, for example, where this is actually a scalar and this is a Bose a vector, a spin one. So you don't necessarily need to do it with fermions, you can do it with bosons as well.
Shouldn't you expect also some background of gamma rays?
But it's not, this is X-ray, so it's not so simple. There are very large backgrounds. So but that's one of the things we are working on. You also have to ask, how would you excite that thing? Where would you excite it? So this is what we have, but let's see whether we can even feed the data. So the mass of that thing will be roughly 100 GeV. We saw already that's the naive mass you get for Dama, but the splitting is roughly 100 KeV, which is 6 orders of magnitude smaller. And just to drive further home, what we really have here is now we should think about our target as having all those little different magnetic dipoles, right, of the nucleus. Dark matter comes in, kicks one of those guys, and leaves. Okay, so very naively, at least you have a dipole-dipole interaction between the dark matter and normal matter. But then you think a little more, you realize relativity also forces another type of interaction. An interaction that you normally won't consider, but because if you just have a magnetic dipole at rest and all the charges of your nucleus, right, all the protons, there will be no force between a magnetic dipole and a charge. But this guy is moving, and as it moves, relativity tells you that you're generating a small electric dipole. Right? Electric dipoles do interact with charge, and so there are two interactions that dominate this scattering. One of them is a dipole-dipole. The other is electric dipole versus against the charge of the nucleus, and you have to take both into account, it turns out. Okay? And actually, I think this is one of the very first examples where those two things play a role, because one of them is velocity suppressed and usually relevant. So let's digress just for one moment let me give you a sense of how would you do such a computation. How many events you're going to see is the basic observable, right? And what would you expect from that? Do you expect from that just n sigma v, right? The rate you observe is the number density times the cross-section times the velocity. That is the most basic formula. Now, this is almost correct. You just have to take into account the fact that dark matter has some sort of velocity distribution in the halo, and your cross-section is actually a function of the energy deposit. But given those simple changes, the differential rate as a function of how much energy you deposit is just given by a convolution of n sigma v against the distribution of velocity in the halo. Okay, but other than that, it's a triviality. The hard part is, of course, what is the velocity distribution in the halo. We have no empirical knowledge of that, and astrophysics is really the region where we, the realm where we can find about that. But there are some simple assumptions. If it's really a gas, which we expect it to be, it should be some sort of Maxwell Boltzmann. Maybe it hasn't virialized completely, so there may be some differences, but more or less it will be a Maxwell Boltzmann. Okay? The particle physics goes into calculating here, and as we already saw, there will be two pieces to that cross-section. There will be a dipole-dipole interaction between the magnetic dipole of dark matter and the magnetic dipole of the nucleus, but there will also be a dipole charge interaction. Okay, and you can go and calculate that. Let me not go too much into the detail. It's a classical computation. Not too many things happening here. But you do it, and then you ask, okay, does that model explain gamma? And here are those plots. So there are two plots for a 70 GeV particle and for a 140 GeV particle. But what I'm plotting here is essentially the inelasticity, so the difference in mass between those two little states, versus the dipole of that matrix element. Okay, so those are the parameters that completely control and fix the scattering cross section. Okay, and the contour here is the best fit for gamma, the 95% likelihood fit, and the other contour is 99%. Okay? And all these different lines that you see is our recomputation of the bounds coming from all those experiments that saw nothing. In fact, they did not all see nothing. Many of them did see events, but in the wrong region for elastic scattering, for in a good region for this sort of model. So in fact, they did see events. I'm not claiming that this is a discovery, but that's one of the things you have to worry about, that it's not all clean plots. And you see that this region parameter space is definitely not excluded. It is still a viable model for dark matter. Instead of bathing in the glory of those plots, let's just ask, is there any way we can discover it and confirm it? And indeed,
I can ask a question?
Yeah.
So because Kim's data, did they have a public paper release?
They didn't have a release.
How did you put the lines in there?
Oh, no, this is the old results.
Oh.
This is the previous. We contacted them and they've been saying for a while now. Sorry, they've been saying soon for a while now. So, hopefully soon. So, I actually think Xenon is definitely going to find it or exclude it rather than waiting for Kim's. Well, this is the current effort. It's 100 kilogram roughly of liquid xenon. Xenon is heavy enough, and as we saw, it has some amount of dipole in it, so you'll definitely see this sort of scattering happening in your detector.
Wouldn't the annihilation rate be too large for these things?
Yeah, for magnetic abundance?
Right, magnetic dipole to plus in one.
So naively, yeah. You can have form factor effects that mitigate that a little bit, because if it's any
component... You're going to model build further, right?
I'm not going to model build further here.
Okay. If that's what
we're
saying.
That's what we're doing, yeah. That's one of the things, that's one of the open questions. There is that, there is annihilation of the sun that you have to worry about.
Lots of pixels, right?
No, actually, annihilation of the sun, I think, works fine. But... I'll tell you that the reason why I find this model interesting is not so much necessarily because it definitely is spending everything, but rather because it forces us to look at regions which we haven't looked quite before. And even just for that, I think it's worth considering, so we make sure we don't miss anything. Because after all, we really don't have any idea of what we're looking for. So this is the current best effort for that, and this is the future. It's a one-ton scale experiment, and almost certainly will happen. So there is at least another decade of times that we'll explore dark matter. Okay, so...
Can I ask, is the Ugly model you know of that is consistent with Dharma and the other experiments?
More or less. There are a couple of other examples. I don't know if they fit Dharma's data that well. Certainly the low mass swim, I think, is, in my mind, is completely excluded. There is resonant dark matter of Paddy Fox and Pies that are really interesting. But it's certainly, if not the only one, it's one of the very few that actually is.
What was the problem that Maxwell mentioned?
So one of the things you have to worry about is if you really believe it's a heavy relic, one of the reasons why we believe in the wimp miracle of a heavy relic like that at all is because there is this coincidence that if you calculate how much of it you should see today, assuming some thermal history of the universe, you get exactly the right number of dark matter. But that for that you need a certain annihilation cross section in the early universe. This model will likely have too large of a cross section, and you end up with too little dark matter.
I was going to ask, you had two plots because you had three parameters to play with.
Yeah.
Are these people going, or is Xenon going to rule it out, or are you still going to be able to tweak
things? I don't think, for this mass region, I don't think you can hide. You can run, but you can
hide. You can't hide. The other thing is, you mentioned, so there's two interactions now, the dipole-dipole and sort of electric dipole charge. Does dipole-dipole still dominate?
No.
So if it doesn't dominate, why was it important then to think about large magnetic?
Oh, it's same order of magnitude.
Maybe that's what the curves are saying, that the interaction rate in the other experiments is comparable.
It's comparable, but, for example, CDMS, which is germanium, which provides one of the best bounds, there it actually doesn't dominate because the charge goes like the charge of the nucleus, and for germanium it's just lower.
Okay.
So there, the dipole-dipole actually is very important.
Okay.
And germanium also doesn't have much dipole, so for CDMS, it would really have lost. It would not have seen.
I mean, this other interaction, the electric, the when you attribute it to relativity, that's really the same as spin orbit coupling, right? It's just another way of looking at spin orbit coupling.
What do you mean exactly by spin orbit coupling? I mean, this
magnetic moment interacting with
yeah, that's right. If you like to think about it from the rest frame of the nucleus, it's the fact that you're moving there. But that would be a little misleading to you because that will not tell you that interaction should go at the velocity of the wind. The reason why I like that argument that I gave is because that immediately tells you that it goes like the velocity of the wind, not the velocity of the electron in the.
By the system, whatever the velocity is, relative
velocity. Right. I'm not sure what exactly you mean by spin orbit, but it's not the electronic spin.
No, he's just using an analogy.
If you go to the rest frame of the wind, it's the interaction of magnetic moment with the motion of magnetic field.
Okay, so. Let me move on to describe to you weak forces and what I'll call the precision frontier. Again, there is a big anomaly there that I'll describe to you, but ultimately what it really illustrates is how rapid all these things are moving forward. So if you want to look for weak forces, you have many options available for you. You can try to look for it in very precise measurements of the properties of fundamental particles. And here, for example, you have the muon anomalous kinetic moment. There are many other such things. Precision measurements of atomic transition, which is what I'll describe in a moment, is another such arena. high-energy colliders, if I have time, I'll show you that new objects appear in that frontier. And another big effort that is undertaken by people here actually at BI, Natalia and Philip and Ruben Essig, is the whole idea of low-energy colliders. And of course, Maxim wrote one of the very first papers on this idea. I don't think you're involved in the experiment, right? But okay, so what I'll describe to you is this for now, and hopefully in the end we'll get to this if we have time. So before I do so, let me just describe to you the simplest of weak forces, because it's also just formally cute. Suppose I take E and M, here is the field strength, and the coupling of the photon to the electromagnetic current. And to that you add another vector boson, which is described again by some field strength, and some mass. Okay? And you stare at this model and you realize right now its life is very boring, but it turns out that if you just add one kinetic mixing, one term which doesn't break any of the symmetries that you had before, it's a mixing between the field strength of one with the field strength of the other, suddenly life becomes interesting. You diagonalize this with a simple transformation that I'll leave it to you to figure out what it is. But what you end up finding is that you are describing electromagnetism once again, but now you have this extra vector boson coupling to your electromagnetic current that you had before here with an epsilon charge. Okay, so everything that had real charge now has also this charge under the new vector boson with an epsilon strength. Okay, so this is how easy it is to create new forces. Let's see if it's even interesting. Where can you probe something like that? Atomic physics. Here is my notion of atomic physics. You have some heavy particle in the middle and some spectator around it that is creating, making life interesting. And for a long while now, we tested quantum electrodynamics, our more successful field theory, in this arena of atomic physics. And the way you do it is that those two particles are coupled by that force, and so there is a first order coupling, and of course you have to add to it second order effects to create a correction of the electron propagator, to create a correction to the vertex, ultimately also the fact that the vacuum itself is polarized, and so you do all those corrections and people do it to third order. Okay, so it's one of the most precise calculations in QED, but at some point you have to compare to experiment, and experimentalists will tell you that you hit a problem, because the fact that the charge of a nucleus is spread over a finite size make it so that you cannot you cannot go to the next order. You have this uncertainty. We don't know what is this finite size. So this was understood about a decade ago or even more, and people started this program of actually measuring this finite size directly. Okay, instead of measuring it in the electronic system, try to find a different system where you can measure it, and then use it as an input to go to higher order in QED and test QED even better. So what is the system? The system is almost the exact analogy, but with the heavy brother of the electron, namely the muon. The reason why this is useful is because the muon sits much closer to the nucleus than the electron, just because it's heavier, and so you get a very precise measurement of the proton radius this way. Okay. This was the promise that we'll measure the proton radius much more precisely. And indeed, the Paul Scherrer Institute went ahead and did it and fulfilled that promise. Okay, so what have they done? This is a plot of the energy levels. You capture the muon on the proton at some very high energy level, let's say n equal to 14. It cascades down. Most of the time, you just decay to the ground state, the 1s state. But every once in a while, like 1% or 3%, you'd actually go to the 2s state. And the 2s state is long-lived because we know conservation of angular momentum tell us you cannot decay directly to the ground state. We need to emit two photons, and that takes a big chunk of phase space. So you'll sit there, and that is good because now you can try to probe the 2s state. And the way they probe it is they shine a laser at the sample, and they try to find what is the frequency at which point the laser will cause this to excite to the 2p state, at which point you'll see all these 2p states decaying back to the ground state. Okay, so what you expect is that as you scan your laser, you'll hit that resonance, at which point you'll see all those photons emerging from your sample, and you can tune to that resonance. Okay? So this is the basic idea, and this is indeed what they see. This is the laser frequency in units that the particle physicists are not used to, but actually 1/s. And this is, of course, the you already told all of you that you're working GV, right? I think Nima said that very emphatically. My guess, he said it to me at some point, so I guess he said it very well. Does the importance of not thinking that you're special. Okay, so this is exactly what they see, and there's this big resonance in between. Okay, and so you measure the laser frequency. Now, as a side note, it's sort of curious that this is the system, or the analog of it, that where the first QED effect was first measured, namely the lamp shift. Okay, this is slightly different than the usual lamp shift because the energy levels are slightly oriented differently, and this is actually the half state to the 3/2. The original lamp shift is half-half. But never mind all that, it's sort of just a curiosity. More importantly, what they measure, as we said, is that energy difference. And so QED tells you that the energy difference is given by something that you can compute directly from QED, and then a contribution that goes like the proton radius. Okay? And again, the reason to understand the minus sign here is that the larger the proton is, the more charge is spread around it, and so the lower the attraction, and so the less negative the potential becomes. Okay, so that's why it contributes to the negative sign compared to the leading order. All right. If you take that and you actually manage to solve the cubic equation correctly, unlike some practitioners in the field, you will find that. For those who know, they know what I mean. You'll find that the experimental result disagrees with the theoretical computation by five orders of magnitude. And what I mean by theory here is actually not really theory. It's the world average of the same measurement in the electronic system. Okay. So that is roughly the disagreement between the proton radius measured in this experiment and all the other experiments that measured the same quantity.
Sorry, just missing. Why is the proton radius important in this? Which energy difference?
Thank you. So you're measuring the 2s state,
yeah,
to the 2p state. The 2s is the wave function is such that there's an overlap with the origin, so you really feel the proton radius. The 2p state to first order approximation doesn't zero. Okay, so what do you do with that? Well, one thing you can do with that is speculate. Can that be a new force? And this is what we have done in this recent work. Can this be some sort of a new vector boson or a scalar that mediate an attraction between the muon and the proton? Remember that you need an attractive force because you have measured the proton radius to be smaller than you expected. Right? That means that you need something to make the proton to cause a similar effect, namely an attractive force.
Is it clear that this one parameter of the radius is enough to characterize? It could have a different shape, or it could.
Good. So the way this is defined, in general, you have some form factor,
right,
to the whole and you expand the form factor in the momentum exchange of the photon. And the proton radius is the first order contribution to that shape. So if you like, it's some sort of a multiple expansion, but in momentum space. This contribution comes from the next corrections to that expansion. But there is no reason to believe that expansion is not valid.
Is that
so? Yeah, there's no reason to assume that. That's one.
Is there an independent parameter for the cubic
term? In principle, this is an independent parameter. But all indication, this whole thing has been measured in other experiments, and all indication, all other data seems to imply that this is not, this is like two orders of magnitude too small to explain the discrepancy. So while this is a possibility, independent data seems to say that this cannot be the issue.
But there is a clear scale separation,
right?
Because the more radius is inverse than you need, so if you really want to play with the shape of
you need something crazy to happen at exactly an MEV, but not happen at higher momentum and not happen at lower momentum, which to me is just like in physics. So, but anyways, so yeah. But there could be other explanations, and I can tell you about them. They also have their own problems. Even this explanation has problems.
Where does it stop on projecting problem?
Say again?
Well, why is there no linear order? Because the linear term, why is there no linear term?
Well, Lorentz inference tells you that the form factor goes like the 2 squared, not q. I mean, you can get square root, but that's a non-analytic behavior of your form factor.
How do you get a cubic?
The cubic is coming from the two-photon exchange diagram. It's not coming from a cubic, cube. It's a definition. This is not... This is defined as a certain integral over the form factor. It has this dimension, but it's not. You shouldn't be thinking about it
as an expansion.
Right. By the way, just a word. This is what's known as the third Zemach monomer. If you are following this definition. Okay. So can that do the job for you? If you have that, what will be the energy shift? It will be something like that, and actually this formula is very simple. Those two coupling is just the fact that you have some sort of strength for the interaction. The 1 over r is just telling you that this is essentially a Coulomb correction, right? This is basically just e squared over r, the Coulomb correction to the energy. This piece here, and by the way, this r is just the wavelengths of that particle, this finite force, right? It has a finite range, so the 1 over r is just a finite range. This piece here is the volume suppression. It has to do with the fact that your wave function has to come close enough to the origin, namely as close as the Compton wavelengths, to start feeling that effect. So you have a volume suppression of that force versus the door radius. And finally, there is some dimensionless functions that affect it a little bit, but not really. So this is the corrected Bohr for that system. So it turns out that can do, and I'll show you in a moment, that can do the job, and I'll show you in a moment the plot. But it turns out that also it amounts for another interesting corrections. For a long while now, people have been measuring the mu anomalous magnetic moment. I remind you that the diamagnetic ratio gets corrected in QED, and so you define this quantity, which is known as A, and that basically tells you what are the QED corrections to the classical computation. And this exact quantity has been measured experimentally. And there is roughly a 3-point something sigma in that measurement. This is taken from Maxim's paper on the subject. And you can get exactly that sort of correction from this diagram. You're correcting the muon propagator. If you compute it, this is actually the classical computation of Schringer of that quantity. Only Schringer did not have a massive boson. So there is some correction because of the fact that it's a massive particle. Okay. So this is where it is. And what happens if you actually try to plot it? This is the diagram. I'm plotting here the mass of that boson versus the energy correction. And this band is the experimental measurement of that energy correction. Okay, if I take the world average for the radius, this is how much energy I'll have to shift it by, like roughly 0.3 millielectron volt. And I'm plotting against it the contribution from a scalar or from a vector to that correction. I normalize my coupling to exactly explain the G minus 2 of the muon. And you see that at an MeV, you're exactly explaining both. Okay, so if you're an MeV particle with a coupling of roughly 10 to the minus 4, can explain both anomalies. Right? Now, this is interesting, but MeV is a really low scale that have been probed since the 40s. Right? So, are there any bounds on that? It turns out that there are constraints. As crazy as it may sound, they're already experimented in Russia in the 50s. That constrain this problem. People did neutron lattice scatterings that constrain that sort of force. Lattice shift in ordinary hydrogen constrain the coupling to electrons. There are actually several other experiments that constrain the coupling to electrons. And finally, you also have to come into terms with the fact that neutrino reactions have in a sense probe that scale. So right now, while it is very interesting that there is this coincidence, there is no good models that actually is a sensible filter. Maybe Maxim now with next report has such a model. But students should, as homework, should go and find such a model.
It's a hard homework.
It's a hard homework, yeah, I should warn you. Okay, but again, are there any predictions? Are there any concrete predictions that one can test? And yes, there are three of them. Muonic deuterium will be measured very soon, and there is a concrete prediction for that model. You should see an energy shift in that system as well. You should see an energy shift for the muonic helium system, and both of those systems will be measured in PSI. I think actually the deuterium might have already been measured.
Yeah, if you stay at the phenological level, you don't know where the coupling to neutron is.
Thank you. So there is a hidden assumption on this number. If there's a coupling to the neutron, this will be two times larger. The reason why right now I'd like to shy away from neutron coupling is because of that. If you believe that somehow those experiments in Russia were not done correctly, for political reasons or otherwise, you may have a factor of two in these predictions. There is another very interesting system, namely true muonium, where you'll definitely see that effect. But that system has actually never been observed, never mind spectroscopy. You've never even observed that system in the lab before. But there is a prediction, and maybe in the next decade we'll be able to measure that. Okay, so let me spend the next 5 minutes of the talk, and I'll imagine that Maxim's introduction was much too long, and I actually started half an hour after. But really, it will really be 5 minutes. So tell you a little bit, how can you see those new forces in the energy frontier? And here the physics is so simple that maybe we'll even need just one slide. So here is your favorite exercise from quantum mechanics. You have a double well potential, but this time I'll put the Stahl model on this side of the potential. Those are the states that the Stahl model has: electron, photons, tops, very heavy, etc., etc. Okay. Now imagine for a moment that somehow there is some other sector out there that is separated from the Stahl model, but it has its own ground state. Okay, that is, there are infinity of models that actually have that sort of thing. What will happen if I give enough energy to any one of those states to overcome this barrier? What will happen is that you will produce those new states. But because you have to produce so much energy, you have to give so much energy, you now have all this energy in kinetic energy. And that means that your entire system is very, very boosted. Okay? But ultimately, those states are unstable, as we know. They will tunnel into the Stahl model, whether you like it or not. But they do so as they are, at the same time, moving very, very fast. So there is just a kinematical must here, namely that the decay products will be extremely collimated. Okay? And that brings about new interesting objects in collider, and they're known as lepton jets. And the most trivial example, for example, if the Z has some, and this is actually motivated by a concrete model, if the Z has some rare decay into a new boson and a new scalar, then what will happen is that those guys, if they're light, like let's say a GP or maybe even a little lower, they will be very boosted. Again, you will first cascade. Remember that in this picture you may have other states here, so there may be some cascade here. And so this guy, for example, will cascade down, and ultimately you have to go back to the Stahl model and you'll choose the lightest states available for you in the Stahl model. But as we said, kinematics just forces this angle to be extremely small, right? Because this angle has to do with the barrier you have to overcome, that's the energy, divided by the mass of these states. Sorry, the other way around. The mass of the states divided by the energy barrier. Okay, so that's just a kinematical feature that will force you to produce those extremely well-collimated objects in colliders. All right? And so we have the one thing you have to worry about is whether you can miss those or whether you can see too much background. So we spent some time worrying about the definition. Let me not spend too much time on that because we're running out of time. The very basic idea is that you define some sort of cone around which you collect those lepton jets. You demand them to be heavier than something, and you require some isolation around them. You don't want to see QCD junk, QCD junk will almost always have other stuff in around it, and so it demands some energy cut on that region, and there you have it. You have a definition of what a lepton jet would be. And people went and searched for it over the zero. Here is the first exclusion of it. I'll just flash it at you. This is exclusion of the photons, that extra state mass divided by against the cross section of the production. It hasn't been found yet, so there's no point of spending too much time explaining those details. But there are lots of efforts now in the LHC trying to look for that. There's an analysis from Atlas coming up, and hopefully one from CMS soon. So let me move towards the conclusions and remind you that what I tried to give you a picture of in this talk is the different frontiers that one can explore phenomenological ideas in. And while there is certainly this energy frontier where some questions must be answered in this frontier, what is what unitarized WW scattering? Is there a Higgs or not? Is there an extra family? All those questions have to do with a new threshold. And they must be answered by going to higher and higher energies. But there are other frontiers, there are other kind of experiments that one can do that are really exploring a whole new territory now, and we'll do so in the next decade or so. And while it is certainly true that the natural evolution is to go to higher energies and possibly higher luminosity, and the LHC will definitely do that. There is a good reason to believe, or there are good chances, or there is reason to hope, that there is something interesting available for us by just going to lower energies, but exploring deeper into those unknown territories, the exposure frontier and the precision frontier. And this is precisely where you expect to find weakly coupled physics. And As I mentioned in the beginning of the talk, that's where direct detection efforts are very important. Large targets like the Sun and the Earth could be very useful. Large luminosity, that there are PIs involved in that effort. In the precision frontier, there are, of course, all the atomic physics experiments and other precision where you measure fundamental particles very, very precisely. And the interesting thing is that there could be an interplay between those different frontiers, and ultimately, you can maybe even see new objects in collider associated with those weakly coupled sectors. Okay, so let me just conclude, because we're out of time. There is no guarantee that we'll find something. As I stressed from the very first slide, there is no principle that tells us that we must see something. There is no unitarity that tells us that something must happen. Dark matter may very well be completely decoupled from the rest of us. But it's important to keep in mind that this is the current picture we have of the universe, where this is us. And in a sense, this is the ultimate, or maybe the penultimate, Copernican revolution, that, you know, we're not the center of, our Earth is not the center of the universe, our solar system is actually not that important, even this galaxy is not that that hot. And it turns out that we're not even made of most of the matter in the universe. So it's important to keep that our place, our little role in life in mind. And in my eyes, it would be a little strange if somehow those different pieces are completely fragmented and independent of each other. I'd like to hope and believe that actually this is the right picture, and something will be fine. So, thank you.
So you had this plot of the lepton jets, and so you're actually sensitive to very light dark photon masses or GV scale. Is that just because the cross section drops with 1 OS?
No. So that cross section is completely independent of the dark photon mass. That cross section was entirely what they simulated is actually supersymmetric production of neutralinos. That cross section is entirely set by the electroweak cross section. The reason why there are variations in it, in that plot, is because how the dark photon decays depends on its mass. Because that is what tells you what is the electromagnetic form factor.
Okay.
So that is the only reason why there are variations in the cross-section, because the branching, what you're really measuring is cross-section times branching ratio, and all the variation is coming from the branching ratio, not from the cross-section.
I know this wasn't the main point of your talk, but a couple of times you mentioned this unitarization of WWC.
Right.
I'm not. Can you say something more about that? Is there,
yeah, so there
is supposed to be a problem in the standard model, or what?
No, because the standard model solves it, but there is a very simple, if you take two quarks, right, you collide them, they can emit two Ws, right? And we know in the sound models that this is a non-abelian game theory, so they scatter. Right? There's a 2 to 2 amplitude that scatters them. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, the problem is that those guys can be longitudinal modes. Right? Longitudinal modes mean that the polarization vector in the rest frame is something like 0, 0, 1. Right? Now, if I boost them, they're very boosted here, right? If I boost this vector, I get something which goes like energy over mass of the W, 0, 0, energy over mass, right? So just the fact that the energy, the polarization goes like that, tells you that this matrix element should diverge roughly like the energy to the force power. However, it's not that as bad as that. Gauge invariance is actually restricting this to be to the second power. There is a gauge coupling here, G square, because this is the non-abelian vertex. So this combination happens to be energy square divided by the dielectric scale. Okay? But that is telling you that diagram diverges. Now you can think about it as perturbation theory is breaking down. That's one way of saying it. But ultimately, the real problem is even if you sum up those diagrams, the what's called the sausage diagrams. You have to face the fact that your this amplitude grows too strong and unitarity will break down, right? Partial wave unitarity. Now the sound model fixes that because at some point you have another diagram, namely the Higgs, right, in the S channel. And that diagram comes with a minus, essentially minus E square over V square. Can exactly cancel that. And there are two other diagrams in the S and P channel. So this is how the sound model fixes that problem. That's not the only way you can do it.
But this fix only works if there really is a Higgs,
right.
Fundamental Higgs, like
right.
It's presumed.
Right. So ultimately, if you really want to make sure that, even if you saw the Higgs, if you really want to make sure it's doing what you think it is, and it's just not just some scalar, that's what you need to measure.
Right. So let's
try
again.